Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Inside the Hive. This is Emily Jane Fox. I'm here with my buddy, co-host, Joe Hagan. Joe, it's been like 200 years. I got a dog jumping on me, kissing on me. She wants to say hi. We both missed you so much.
Well, that is very sweet. I can see that dog. You can't in podcasting world, but you'll have to trust me that it's very cute. And having a dog interrupt this podcast like right in the first 5 seconds is somehow poetic. To me.
I agree. It feels full circle. You and I we've talked offline, but we haven't talked on the podcast in some weeks. I'm really so happy to be back talking with you, and particularly in a time when we have so much stuff to discuss. Trump possibly getting indicted this week. We thought it was last week. Is it going to be next week? Michael Cohen is back at the center of it, and it feels sort of fitting because you and I are rounding out on the third anniversary of taking over this podcast, which sometimes feels like a million years ago and sometimes feels like yesterday. And I feel like we've done some pretty good things in 3 years.
Absolutely. I was just listening this morning to De La Soul's The Magic Number. Three is the magic number. With my daughter, my teenage daughter.
Ugh, I can't believe
it. Who's just discovering it.
When we started this podcast, you did not have a teenager. So that just gives you a concept.
Yeah, you didn't have a daughter.
That's true. She was just a figment of imagination. And now you and I are recording this. It's quite early. I'm in pajamas. You're in a suit, which feels real East Coast, West Coast vibes. You have a magazine awards dinner tonight because you are an incredible features writer. And that brings us to a little announcement that we have here on Inside the Hive. After 3 years of doing this together, you and I are both taking a step back from the podcast. The podcast isn't going anywhere. It's taking a little bit of a break, a breather, while you and I get back to doing the thing that I think we both love to do the most. As much as we loved hosting this podcast, I think you and I are both naturally magazine reporters, and it's a rare thing that we have both found something that we are absolutely head over heels obsessed with, and that thing takes a lot of time and energy, and so does making a podcast, and we've loved making this podcast. But I think you and I are both just ready to go back to doing our first love after this very, very, very fun love affair that we've had.
It's the final dance of Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers of Inside the Hive.
Which one are you?
I could be Ginger Rogers.
Okay. I'd be happy to be either of them, honestly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're, you know, it's a gender neutral podcast. Sure. So, yeah, we have been through a lot. When we started this podcast, there was a pandemic just beginning. And then we were thrown into the maw of this thing, taking it from our good friend, Nick Bilton. I think maybe we appeared on his podcast, and then we just took the baton from there, and the world was just beginning anew, horribly. And so we kind of ran with it and had, you know, a Trump election and a pandemic double whammy. And wow, it's, you know, we should probably, Condé Nast should pay us for, like, you know, for therapy and trauma related injury, just having to report on some of this stuff.
Well, maybe we should pay it because
yeah, because they gave us so much news.
Well, in some ways, it was therapy for us. We were dealing with the world shut down. I kind of forgot until you just said that Trump was still president when we started. It feels like so long ago,
yeah.
But he was still president. We went through a presidential election, and having the space to talk with you through all of that craziness was really helpful, particularly when you were at a time where you didn't have that much interaction, and our audience more than anything, and the feedback we've gotten and the support and the community that we've built has been so personally touching, I know, to both of us, and was the reason why we sweated it out and booked great interviews and kept up on all the news. And so much has changed, and I think we've both grown so much as people, definitely as podcasters and reporters. But the world has shifted so markedly and shifted back so markedly,
yeah,
in the last 3 years, and to get to have this place to talk through it all with you, my friend, my brain trust, has been a true gift and a wonder. And getting to do that in front of an audience is scary and delightful, and has really been the gift of a life as a reporter.
Yeah. I think one of our episodes was actually recorded while I was in the parking lot after getting my first COVID vaccine.
It was, I remember.
So that, just to give you a sense of like the things that have happened on this podcast, it's been a learning curve, a very steep learning curve. It was like, we did it on the fly with Elmer's glue. We kept it going from week to week. And it's been kind of amazing. When I would be afraid to listen to some of the first episodes of just how kind of deer in the headlights the whole thing kind of was. But
well, I mean, I've like literally never listened to an episode in which I'm on. I listened to your episodes, but I could never. But
it's hard.
I mean, I just think back. I remember batching a bunch of interviews, being so pregnant. I remember having contractions during one particular interview. So much has happened for me personally. I got engaged. I got pregnant. I got married. I quit Twitter, which feels like sort of in that same level of importance.
Delicious.
You know, I recently deleted all of my tweets. And
I did that too, and it was so that's an emotional release.
Wait, I know nothing about this
in itself,
so this may be really ignorant, but I feel like I was baptized. I don't know if this is what being baptized feels like, and I understand that doesn't generally
happen.
New word
for Twitter baptism.
Yeah, I felt very cathartic. Also, when you do it, you know, Twitter doesn't allow you to do it, or at least I don't know how to do it through Twitter, so you have to do this third-party service. And it has a capacity for a week. So for a week, half of your tweets, or however, depending how often you tweet, they get deleted, and then you have to go back again and delete the rest. And so the only tweets I had for a while were like from 2013, because everything between now and 2013 got deleted. And so I was looking at those, and I was like, oh God, like, you just shared so much more of yourself in 2013. I think that there was like, it was just because I was super young and like a new reporter, and I was a year out of journalism school. And so you just share more of yourself. And maybe social media was a way more hospitable place at that point, where you didn't have, or at least I didn't have, people making comments and sharing them around. And I didn't see anything that I was embarrassed by, but I definitely saw my own personal growth of, well, do I need to share my opinions on the Emmy Awards ceremony, yep, with my followers? Like, who in the world cares what I think about that? And I sort of feel like that at this juncture in my life, I don't know that I need to publicly share myself. And I want to protect that piece. The world's a different place, and politics are a different place. And getting to talk through all of this with you is amazing. And I keep hoping to do that with you offline.
Yeah. Well, definitely, certainly. And I will say that, you know, you talk about that 2013 tweets, and there was a time, and now it seems almost funny that you even would reflect on it because it's become so baked into our culture. But like, oversharing was Twitter's business plan, right? Everybody should share themselves, and the more you share themselves, the more successful it will be, right? And sort of the nadir of that is like, obviously, like Elon Musk buying so far into it that he buys the thing, and now it's worth half what he paid for it. And that seems like poetic in and of itself, to watch Twitter kind of implode under its own narcissism, which is, you know, fine by me and kind of a relief, as we're discussing here. And the culture is shifting. We're in a very unusual, we have been in an unusual place for a long time, since at least 2016, and watching our world kind of creative destruction vortex. And we don't never really know where it's going to be next. But for instance, people listening to this podcast might be surprised that it's the last one with you and I as co-hosts. And that's another revolution. Aha. But a good one, positive for readers of print, because they're going to see a lot more of us.
The 2024 election means this year is going to be chock full of drama and nail-biting suspense. You deserve a politics and news podcast with expert analysis. No spin, no BS. Just trusted journalists talking about what you need to know. I'm David Plotz, and each week on Slate's Political Gabfest, I sit down with the New York Times' Emily Bazelon and CBS News' John Dickerson to do just that. Join us as we unpack the latest in politics, news, and the courts. Listen to the Political Gabfest every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.
How is your social battery right now? Is it bursting with energy or drained? How do you recharge it? Have you ever reflected on those questions? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. And if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/hive today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/hive.
One of the things you and I talked about a lot on this podcast through the many episodes was what would happen with Trump. And there were moments where we were either skeptical or optimistic that one day he would see justice of some kind. And is there such a thing as justice for Trump? And, you know, would that be pressing some button that would cause a civil war? There's a lot of talk about that, fear of it. Through the years, I've always been skeptical that that would ever happen. That would be in it. Like, people think that, oh, if he is in shackles, which he would love because that would just suit his own narcissistic needs to be seen, you know, perp walked or whatever, would that lead to some kind of like Jan 6-2, Wrath of Khan, right? I don't believe that personally, but where do you, as a great reader of Trump tea leaves, Trump family tea leaves, tell us like where we stand as you understand it and where you think things are going to land with all this.
Oh gosh, I don't know. I don't know what's happening with the grand jury right now. And probably, I don't know, the second we end recording, there's going to be some answers to this question. So I don't, yeah. I think I've learned exactly enough in my years reporting on Trump and talking about Trump here enough to not predict what's going to happen. I think that Trump is staring down the barrel of consequences for the first time in a way that I have been pretty sure that he hasn't been going to face them in my years talking about him and reporting on him, not just in New York, but in Georgia and in the obstruction case with the Mar-a-Lago classified documents. We're at a point where we're still so far away from the election. I think the fact that it is bringing out a conflict with DeSantis this early on, and that Trump is really getting a chance to workshop early nicknames and to imply all sorts of pretty damaging things about him, and to really turn some of the Republican infighting out so early. I know I've been seeing people who are Trump supporters react not so positively, and I don't know where it's going to go in terms of what this means for his base. You know, his base is dwindling, but it's still mighty. And so I don't know what this will mean for him in terms of indictment. I don't know what it will mean for our country. I don't think even 6 months ago, if Trump had been indicted, I think there would have been far more of a rallying cry. I remember at some point in the fall when the feds executed the search warrant in Mar-a-Lago, I felt like, whoa, this is a tinderbox and I don't know what's going to happen. This is going to be a landslide for Trump. I don't have that feeling anymore. I think the further we get out from 2020, the less I can imagine going back there and the less I can imagine the country having an appetite for going back there. But I do see a world in which Trump could win a nomination because of this, just the way that primaries work. And even if Trump is still holding on to 20%, that 20% is going to be the 20% that shows up to vote in a primary. So, I guess my answer for you is I don't know where this is going, but I can't see going far backwards, and I can see a world in which at least one of these indictments brings consequence to Trump for the first time. And I've been talking about and asked a lot about over the last couple of weeks, Michael Cohen, and I did the show The Circus this weekend with our buddies who've been on the podcast a bunch of times, and we were talking about all about Cohen, and in the Chyron introducing me, it said that I have written about Cohen more than 36 times, and I basically fainted. I guess I maybe blacked it out or have amnesia about the fact that, A, I've written anything 36 times. I can't even imagine what that number would be like for members of the Trump family. But, you know, the pace at which we were all cranking during that era is so crazy to me now. And there was a lot to report on about their relationship and about just all the news of the fallout. And Mark McKinnon, who was interviewing me, asked me, is this all about revenge for Cohen? And I think there's some of that. But I think when I had been interviewing Cohen all that time, and I haven't talked to him in a while, but when we were in the thick of it and I was talking to him so often, the thing that was really ringing true to me was the fact that he was the only person in the entire circle who had felt consequences, real consequences. You know, a lot of people who had been around him felt social consequences or maybe some financial consequences. But Cohen very clearly felt real consequences. He was sentenced to 3 years in prison and lost his law license and et cetera, et cetera. I would hope that someone else feels consequences for doing illegal things. Do I think that we need to see Trump doing a perp walk in order to know that there's justice in this world? I don't. I think that there's a world in which we can all make peace with what happened and what has happened to his life without seeing this. But I understand a need for people who know him and people who have just been party to him over the last 6 years to feel like he is not above the law and he can't, in fact, shoot someone down the middle of Fifth Avenue and get away with it.
Well, the question will be, the next presidential election will be advertised by the Republicans as it's a change election, right? They'll be selling change. Now, the question will be, how radical of a change will people want, including Republicans, right? Do they want that psychodrama back in their life, right? That's what Trump sells, is psychodrama. And what will be the appetite? God knows, but I pray that it won't want that level of psychodrama.
You know what really bugs me, and maybe it's so different for news reporters who are in this every day in a way that you and I are not anymore, but there's all this criticism all the time that says like, oh, the media would love Trump to run again because it's great for business. And I can only speak to for myself and like maybe a little bit you. I would like nothing less.
Not at all. Not at all. I just...
I'm tired of the conversation. Just let him go off into the sunset and live his life. If I never had to write another word about it, as busy as writing words about him has kept me and has propelled me to a level of doing what I'm doing, and I'm so grateful for what I have done. But God, there's so many other things to write about and to talk about, and for these brief shining moments on this podcast and in print that we have been freed from talking about this, I feel like I've gotten to write about and talk about so many interesting things, and there's so many greater issues and more juicy stories to cover than Trump. And I just long for a world when the things that matter or the things that entertain are the things that we have time for.
Yeah. And we, many of the stories that we've begun to write in print are about non-Trump things and have been, and they've been incredibly refreshing. And it's the nature of Trump, and the fascist nature of Trump, is that he would like to consume everybody's narrative, right? And to the degree we let him do that is the degree to which we, you know, cede all of our consciousnesses to him and to that psychodrama, right? I think last week's news cycle was not a great optimistic moment for us, because he merely said he was going to be arrested on a Tuesday with no information, no factual basis for it. And a lot of the cable news press followed him there, right? You know, New York Times put it on A24, you know, to their credit. And I did notice that as this, you know, micro or sort of as this news plot was sort of chewed over, it didn't really spend a lot of time at the top of the New York Times' website. And if we think of the New York Times as sort of a bellwether for the rest of the press, which it often is, that's good. So hopefully we will see some legal ramifications for Trump that I think are well-deserved. And, you know, I think that it will bring a lot of the political impact on the right will be that there'll be a conversation on the right about is this what we want, and is this worth it? And it will give political ammunition to other Republican candidates who are trying to develop a storyline. You know, I just saw that Chris Christie thinks that he might have some chance in hell as well. But who knows? We don't know. And for the time being, let's wrap that story up in a bow and put it over here under a rock for now.
Speaking of wrapping in a bow, I know you have a fancy award to get to. And I will say that this is definitely not goodbye for this podcast. It will be back in a mightier, greater form. And I'm so excited to see where it goes. And I know that you and I will be back. This is
sure.
Inside the Hive is inside our hive. And it is in the Vanity Fair family, as you and I are. And I have no doubt that when it comes back stronger than ever, better than ever, greater than ever, you and I, well, I can only hope that we will get to be part of that in some way and get to come on here and talk to each other and other colleagues and rap about the news of the day. And I know that there's going to be a moment, whenever it is, that you and I text each other and say, God, I wish we could talk about this on a podcast together. Maybe we'll get to. So I'm so grateful for
Absolutely.
You. And I'm so grateful for our audience for letting us talk to each other, talk all these things out for the last 3 years. It's been such a joy. And truly, we've been through it all. And I'm just so grateful for everyone's time and ears and thoughts with us as we worked through it.
Yes. And thank you, Emily, for, you know, keeping me balanced, keeping the balance and making it a joy for me to pop on here and address the world and the news. It's been an adventure, a major league adventure. and one that I know we won't forget. And I'm excited to see what all the other talent we've got in the Hive can do with this machine.
Me too. Well, we will see you when we see you. Take care. And again, thank you for everything.
Farewell.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
From PRX.